for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Mark Brazaite's latest collection of short stories evokes the century-old novel Winebergo, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson. Brazaite's fictional town is named Sherman, Ohio. Residents struggle with life, mental illness, and simply the human condition, just as the book's author did. Mark Brazaite joins me in the studio to talk about the incurables and how he eventually found hope after depression. We'll take your calls throughout the hour. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, Mark. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you very much for having me.
It's my pleasure, Mark. Tell us about Sherman, Ohio, and the people there.
Well, I picked a fictional town in Ohio. I grew up in Cleveland, so I know Ohio well. I feel comfortable with Ohio. I've actually spent the last 13 years of my life in West Virginia, and I still don't understand it, but I think I understand Ohio. So I chose an Ohio town and fictionalized it because I didn't want people to look for specific landmarks and wanted to populate it with people who were struggling with issues of mental illness that Americans all over the country and indeed all over the world are confronting.
And to what extent were you drawing on your own personal experience?
Well, it certainly evolved out of my personal experience. I wish it hadn't done that. I think it, having suffered from severe depression as I did, was without a doubt the most excruciating experience of my life. But being a writer, when I saw the other side of it or got to the other side of that depression, I thought, I've got to write about this. I've got to write about it because I want people to know about the experience. I want people to understand the experience, not my experience necessarily, but the experience that millions of people across this country, across this world, experience every day. And so there was that compulsion. And it was also my own way of laughing or triumphing over what I'd gone through, of saying, I'm going to have the last laugh in this encounter with depression.
You know, it's interesting that you say you wanted to have the last laugh, because some of these stories are, well, they're all very serious and some extraordinarily tragic. The first story, The Bridge, tell us about that.
Well, the origin of the story, we have a bridge in Morgantown, West Virginia, and I used to walk over it every day to go to work, and I imagined, well, what if there was a couple standing on that bridge and an observer saw them jump from the bridge? What would happen from that standpoint? And that's where the story grew, and eventually it wasn't just that couple. It was a number of people who began jumping from that bridge.
There's an epidemic.
There is an epidemic in that story, right. It evolves from two people to just about everyone, not only in the town, but in the country, and people are coming from all over the world. It's this blooming suicide epidemic. And really, though, the focus of that story is the central character, the sheriff, who's having to confront this issue, not only the public safety issue of a bridge gone mad or a world gone mad, but his own feelings of depression and his own sense that this bridge is calling to him somehow.
The sheriff is dealing with not only what he can do about this bridge, he tries to, in effect, through netting, through barriers, through all kinds of techniques, to literally wall off the bridge. Is that bridge symbolic for depression itself?
I think it is. It's interesting, the bridge as metaphor, and bridges do connect us, right? But there's a certain danger, obviously, in this bridge. And he's treating the certain part of the problem, but the problem exists beyond the bridge. We can wall off the bridges, but as a society, can we really wall off depression? And the And you mentioned humor in the stories, and reviewers have been kind enough to point out that many of the stories, in addition to being tragic, as you said, also have strong elements of humor. And I wanted that to counteract the sadness. I didn't want to leave readers with a terrible taste of hopelessness. I think there is a triumph in being able to laugh at this situation. But the sheriff in this story connects with a sorority president who attempts to help him, and their friendship forms the hopeful message in the piece, that through connection, through friendship, perhaps we can overcome some of the inner demons that we're facing.
You went through your own depression, your own period of real hopelessness, as your father, Tom Brazaitis, whom I knew well, who was a dear friend, was going through his own bout of cancer. In your own mind, did you connect the two?
I didn't then, but I certainly see a connection now. I think when my dad had cancer of kidney cancer, and it inevitably became it was inevitable that he was going to die from it. I understood that intellectually. I accepted that intellectually. I did not accept it emotionally. I didn't realize I didn't accept it emotionally at the time. It took me a while after he died to realize I didn't accept it. I didn't accept it. I didn't go through a pre-grief period. I just accepted it platonically. And then, and I should say about my dad, he was a terrific man, a generous man, a wonderful writer, my favorite writer of all time.
Columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
That's right. He wrote very lucid prose, admired him greatly. But like all father-son relationships, it was complicated.
Of course.
And he was very ambitious for himself and for me, and sometimes our ambitions competed with each other, and sometimes they didn't. In fact, I have a story called The Boy Behind the Tree in the collection that's based on that relationship of trying to find a connection with one's father. So he's been an inspiration in many ways. But yes, that was one of the things that certainly I could point to. And I think William Styron in his memoir says, well, William Styron can point to the fact that my mother died when I was young as the core source of my depression. Abraham Lincoln had a similar issue in his life. His mother died young, and he could perhaps, if he were to look in his past, he could point to that issue. I didn't necessarily have the same thing. My mother was still alive. I had a nice family. So I wondered. I went on this mad search as I was becoming depressed, looking for that core thing I might pluck out or soothe or do something to change the depression. I was like Indiana Jones looking for the Ark of the Covenant. It was like Raiders of the Lost Mind or something with me. But yeah, and my grandmother had just died. So there's a number of issues that were in play, I think, in my own depression. But some of it remains a deep mystery to me.
Some therapists, of course, argue that depression is the flip side of anger. Do you see that in your own life?
Well, I think there's some validity to that, at least as I interpret it personally. I think there's a lot to be angry or upset about in the world. And I look out into the world a lot. I look at global warming, or I look at mountaintop removal. I look at the general attitude of our politics that seems so divisive, almost a gleeful divisiveness, a showmanship divisiveness. Where is the embracing of the people as a common cause? We have things in common. We need to move forward together. But there are these issues that are looming and seem troublesome and, again, perhaps a lot to get angry at.
Mark Brazaitis, he's director of the Creative Writing Program at West Virginia University. He's an award-winning author of several books and a collection of poetry. His newest book of short stories is titled The Incurables. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Tell us about The Boy Behind the Tree.
Well, this is a story of a young man whose father, like my own father, loves golf and wants his boy to play with him. It would be their kind of unifying field, their way of coming together. The boy, however, is not a good golfer and doesn't like the game and has other interests that the father doesn't have or the father doesn't connect with. And so there's a kind of struggle about whose game will prevail. Will the father be able to convince the son to play golf? Will the son be able to introduce the father to his own world? Or what will happen to this relationship? What common ground will they find? And then there's a third character introduced who does like golf. He's the son's age. And so this rival for the father's affection is introduced. And the story is about the strains on the father-son relationship because of this other boy who seems ideal in a sense. He loves golf. He's a good golfer, and he has a rapport with the father that the son lacks.
And what was it like to get inside the head of that young boy?
I think in some ways it was familiar because, as I said, any father-son is going to have those kinds of struggles to find common ground and yet to find unique ground for oneself. And in another respect, of course, it's a little painful and a little difficult to contemplate a relationship in my life, even through fiction, that is so important and yet has elements of difficulty. But that's what we do as fiction writers. We open ourselves to those very painful truths in our own lives and in the lives of our characters.
Mark Brazite is Director of Creative Writing at West Virginia University. His new book of short stories is titled The Incurables. And welcome back. Mark Brazaitis is with me. He is a writer, a poet, the author of a new collection of short stories titled The Incurables. And at the beginning of the program, we talked about his story, The Bridge, where a new sheriff has to confront a suicide epidemic. Mark, would you read for us?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Thank you. And this is Sheriff Lewis as he watches this on TV. He's been up pretty much all night handling the suicide epidemic on this bridge in his town, and he's clicking on the morning news here. And Cece is the other character mentioned, who's the president of the sorority, who's working with him and trying to solve the problem of the suicide bridge. He clicked on the TV on the kitchen table. On its 12-inch screen, he recognized the scene immediately, the south end of the Main Street Bridge. A woman with buttercup blonde hair was on live interviewing people about why citizens of Sherman were throwing themselves off the bridge. Because it was 6:30 in the morning, her subjects were either old people who, having gone to bed before 8 the previous evening, were alert and coherent, or Ohio Eastern University students who had stayed up all night, perhaps in expectation of seeing another jumper, and were delirious. There were a large number of people in the background, like spectators at a high wire act without a net, Sheriff Lewis thought. I think people in this town and in towns everywhere across the country have turned their backs on Jesus, said a white-haired woman. What they're left with is the devil or self-destruction. Maybe self-destruction is the better choice. I think it's like the Bermuda Triangle, said a young woman, half of whose black hair was dyed bubblegum pink. Her eyes darted around as if they were viewing a frenetic tennis match. The bridge is haunted, and I bet when people cross it, they hear voices saying, jump, jump, jump. I'm telling you, there's an evil presence here. I'm willing to bet there are very strong gusts of wind that are lifting people off the bridge, said a young man who may have been sporting a goatee or may have forgotten to wipe his chin after eating chocolate pudding. If the mayor of Sherman was willing to put up some windbreaks, I'm sure we would see a decrease in the number of so-called suicides. The last person interviewed was Cece, who, after spitting out a couple of sunflower seeds, said she couldn't explain the suicides. My only concern is to stop them, she said. Today I'm meeting with the director of mental health at University Hospital, and I'm hoping to have two volunteer counselors down here by noon. Last-minute therapy might be exactly what people need to keep living. As the anchorwoman asked a question of the blonde correspondent, the camera showed Sherman police officers escorting groups across the bridge. After they'd crossed, some people chose to recross. The bridge, Sheriff Lewis could see, was becoming an amusement park ride. As the blonde correspondent summed up the situation using words such as strange, disturbing, mysterious, weird, and wacky, Sheriff Lewis saw a blue van drive slowly past her and onto the bridge. The color and design of the license plate weren't ones he recognized.
And that is Mark Brazaitis reading from his story, The Bridge, part of his new collection titled The Incurables. What is it that you think becomes such a fascination when people are so low that they're willing to take their own lives?
The fascination that people have over this, I think some of it is, I think it goes back to why we watch Greek tragedy, in a sense, that these are characters or people who have been pushed to the extreme of what human beings can face, and there's a natural curiosity, a fascination, an interest in what those people are encountering, and perhaps a certain relief in being the observer rather than the participant, because really it would be so easy to be the participant if life had just been, had gone a different, slightly different way.
Did you ever consider suicide?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Not only considered, but made a feeble attempt at it. And that's when it was time to go into the hospital, which I did. I was taken to a my wife was extraordinary throughout this process. My family, my sister, my brother-in-law, my mother, everyone, my father, everyone has contributed to this. And I'm fortunate that they were able to see the problem a lot more clearly than I was. I was so depressed, I was psychotic. And I was taken to a mental health facility in New York and spent 4 months there. I now like to refer that to that period as my research for The Incurables, but it was where I eventually began to get better, to emerge out of this horrendous mental illness, this depression that I was facing.
How did you emerge?
Well, I needed electric shock therapy, ECT, eventually. I tried a lot of several of the medicines, the antidepressants, and they just weren't doing it for me. And I felt like I was, the situation, I guess, is akin to, on Mac computers, there's that colorful rainbow pinwheel. When a program isn't functioning correctly, it spins around and around and around. And that was what my depression was doing, my brain was doing. It was spinning around and around and really pulling me in deeper. And the ECT, after the first treatment, and I reference this fictionally in my story afterwards, after that first treatment, I immediately began to feel better.
Better.
Better, yeah. It was, I needed that reboot. I needed that reboot. Just like a computer needs the reboot when it has the colorful pinwheel, I needed a reboot for my brain. It had spun into the ditch, into a deep ditch, into a hole, into a canyon.
And your family remained very supportive.
They remained very supportive. Clearly, they were going through their own emotions relating to it, but their support was incredible. My wife researched everything. She researched ECT, gave it a enormous amount of thought whether this was going to be the right thing for someone who needs his brain to make a living, and was tremendous in being able to move this forward and to find the cure that I needed.
Prior to that intense depression, where were you and what were you doing?
Well, I was at West Virginia University teaching, and it was really a slow spiral down, I think, into depression, at least. And I did a little cheating. I talked to my wife last night to review for the show today. So we went over some of the history, because some of it is still vague for me because I was so depressed. I had a hard time. I don't remember a lot of it, or not clearly. But I think it was a slow drip into depression. And then finally, I just couldn't really get out of the bed in the morning, or found myself on my office floor for hours, just unable to get up. And was still trying to teach and was doing it okay, but there reached a point where it was just not working anymore.
And did your employers come to you, or did you voluntarily say, I can't do this anymore?
I had to let them know that this was what was going on and I would need my classes covered. And fortunately, I have excellent colleagues, generous colleagues at West Virginia University who's stepped up and took my classes. I was teaching three classes at the time, which is not easy to do under ordinary circumstances.
Yeah.
And when you're spiraling into depression, it was not the right recipe for recovery. So generously, they stepped in and took the classes. And I did have to take a medical leave, and I wasn't paid for most of it. Fortunately, you know, I was lucky. I had the resources. My family had the resources. Not a lot of people have those same resources, which makes this such a difficult issue for a lot of people who are suffering from mental illness.
There are a number of people going through depression who feel as though they don't want to give up that depression, that going on to medication or undergoing electroshock therapy might take something away. Were you at all concerned about that? And did you feel there was any loss?
I was terrified that if I went on medicine, that I would lose what I had as an artist, as a writer. I eventually got over that and tried the medicine. I was equally as terrified that if I went through electroshock therapy, ECT, I would lose my creativity, the powers of my brain to do what I was meant to do or believed I was meant to do, which was to write. And I resisted that, and it's funny. And there are many humorous incidents that come out of being in a psychiatric ward, but some of the two women there looked at me from the first day and said, you know, you need ECT. You're the guy who needs it. And I said, yeah, I was resisting that. But they knew right from the beginning. And it took me a long time to get that to that place. But after a while, you think you've got to do something because you're not writing. I'm not writing when I'm depressed. I'm not creating now. So, yeah, I was hugely resistant to that. And I'm glad I got over that. On the other side, I've never written better. I feel so much better, and my art is all the better for it.
I have to say, personally, that I've been reading these stories every single night and am so drawn into them. I think you write beautifully.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you.
Mark, there are some of your characters who get very involved in, or at least consider, extramarital relationships. Do you think that for your characters, is part of what one does to escape depression?
I think it may be. I think the midlife crisis, we laugh about it sometimes, you know, the guy who gets a mistress and a Ferrari or whatever it might be. But I think there is a connection. My midlife crisis happened to take place for four months in a psychiatric ward. Other people drive Ferraris, but I think there is some need to be relieved, especially at certain points in the human life cycle, and maybe affairs are a kind of antidepressant, a destructive one. I'm not recommending them. I don't approve in my own life, but I understand why people, and that's why I have characters who make those decisions.
Who run away from what is real into what becomes fantasy.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, and escaping the problems and pressures of their own lives through fantasy. And sometimes it's connected, as it is in some stories here, with the desire to be young again or to recapture one's youth. I have a story, the third story in the collection, A Map of the Forbidden, for example, is about a man whose father has died, who this is sounding familiar, and meets up again with a woman from his past, from high school, who admired him when he was in high school. So here's an opportunity not only to have an affair with an attractive woman, but in a sense to go back to a more innocent, joyous, hopeful time.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to ask you about this story afterwards, because it's really stunning. And a man kills his entire family because he fears what's coming.
Yeah, and I think that connects to what I was saying earlier about what we're angry at in the world. And his particular vision has to do with, well, an apocalypse of global warming and oil running out and the economy running amok. And he sees this horrible vision and he believes it because he's depressed and he's psychotic. And it's so powerful in his mind that he believes the only way to escape it is to kill his family. He thinks he's doing it in his psychotic state. He's thinking this out of mercy, in a sense.
So they won't have to experience these horrible tragedies.
Exactly. And the kids have, his two children have some medical issues. And so he's in an apocalyptic world. He's worried about the enormous pain they would suffer because of what's to come. And so he does this in his deranged mental ill capacity. And then it's about his friend, the really lone friend who stands beside him throughout this, who's having his own family issues. His wife and child, his wife has left him because he's abusive and not very cognizant of how he's contributed to the downfall of his own marriage. But through his relationship with his friend Ray, he begins to see things in his own life and his own marriage that aren't necessarily parallel, but do suggest something powerful about the way he now wants to behave, the way he wants to give to his wife and family. And of course, there are real-world examples of this kind of situation. And I never, ever, as an artist, would have been able to approach understanding these characters, particularly the man, Ray, who kills his family, if I hadn't gone through that kind of immense depression that I did. So it was a leap artistically to write about this situation, and yet I could sympathize.
You could sympathize.
Well, I knew what it meant to be afraid of the world that was coming or that was. I knew what it meant to... Who doesn't have concerns about where the world is headed, what global warming is doing, et cetera. But I also knew what it meant to be psychotic. I was, in my deepest depths, psychotic. I couldn't trust anything. I felt like I was in a foreign country and didn't understand the language. I didn't trust my wife. I didn't trust my father. I didn't trust my sister because I'd been reduced to this ball of anxiety and mistrust. And so out of that, on the other side, again, I'd recovered. I'd had the treatment. I had perspective. I was able to have a little glimpse into what people like my character Ray in Afterwards in The Incurables was facing.
And what it said to me which I've known for most of my life, is the value of relationship.
Absolutely. And many of the stories in The Incurables are about friendships or connections or relationships and how we need each other and we need to forgive each other and understand each other and be there for each other in whatever capacity we can. I think some of these characters gain their strength through, ultimately, through single connections with friends or lovers or family members.
We're going to take a break now, but I want you to know we have an email from Mike who says, I have never heard anyone so articulate speak so graphically and honestly about their depression. Absolutely fascinating. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our holiday series featuring a few of our favorite interviews of the year. We'll hear from Aaron Sorkin, the creator of the TV series The West Wing and this year's HBO series The Newsroom. And we'll hear from this year's National League Cy Young winner R.A. Dickey, who's famous for his knuckleball and was just traded by the Mets to the Blue Jays. Join us.
And if you just joined us, Mark Brazaitis is with me. He's director of the creative writing program at West Virginia University. He has just come out with a new book, a collection of short stories. It's titled The Incurables. Here's an email from Thomas, who says, as someone who's been personally struggling with depression off and on over the last 6 years, how did you summon the courage to seek help? And what steps did you take to seek help for your depression?
Well, that's a great question. I think we hear so much misinformation about depression and mental illness that it's laziness or it's selfishness somehow, and so there's a real stigma attached to it, especially, I think, for men who need to tough it out on their own and be strong. And I fell prey to those kind of stereotypes and misrepresentations and tried to be strong, and that's in quotes, by the way, the strong. But ultimately, I kept becoming worse. I couldn't get out of bed at all. I mean, when before I could get out of bed for a meal, now I couldn't get out of bed at all. And I think, for one thing, I was crying out for help to my family, who also was having trouble initially recognizing it as depression, because they'd seen me as a different kind of person or visualized me as a different kind of person. So it was a long process, or maybe it seems long in retrospect, but it was a process by which I reached out to my family and said, I need help, and a process for them in seeing that I needed help. And then when you become so depressed that you are threatening to take your life or make feeble attempts at such, then it's clear, and it has been for a while, and it should have been, that it's time to take more constructive action and get serious medical help.
Did they get the help for you, or did you get it yourself?
Well, my wife initially brought me to the hospital at WVU, and I spent a week in that hospital. But my family, in the meantime, researched the best care that they could find and believed that it was in New York at the New York State Psychiatric Institute, and took me from Morgantown to New York. And my brother-in-law works at the Columbia Hospital connected with the New York State Psychiatric Institute. So they were very vigilant about getting me help. But I do think it was a combination of me expressing a need for help and my family recognizing that I needed it and getting it. In my position, it was tough. I was so depleted as a person that it would have been hard for me to organize what my family organized in terms of my health care. But it's so crucial to make your situation known. There's no glory in toughening it out. That is the weak move. The strong move is saying, I need help. Could you please get me help?
Here's an email from Bob, who says, ECT is electroconvulsive therapy. My wife is going through this right now. I'm glad to hear it worked for your guest. What's involved with electroconvulsive therapy?
Well, usually it's about 8 to 12 treatments twice a week, and it's being wheeled in on a gurney into a room and having a bunch of equipment attached to one's body and being put under anesthesia and essentially given a shock that's no more powerful than the standard light bulb, something like 75 watts. I'm not sure if I'm explaining that correctly, but it's a very light shock to the system. But it, as I said earlier, it's a reboot to the brain. It's an attempt to reposition the brain out of the horrible realm of depression and into something more like what the person has been used to. And it's not easy and it's not fun, although one of my fellow patients in the New York State Psychiatric Institute was bipolar and had been through several courses of electroshock or ECT over his life. And he was talking to a nurse one day and he said, you know, I really want to do it without the anesthesia this time, as if it were an amusement park ride. I guess he'd been through it long enough. He wanted to really experience it. I wouldn't recommend that, but that was interesting to hear from him. So I think a lot of stigma associated with it. But boy, if you're so depressed and you need an out, it's something to consider.
Is there a difference between electroconvulsive therapy and electroshock therapy?
No, I think they're interchangeable terms. In fact, ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, is the more correct term. We know electroshock from
One
Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, And it's much advanced since those days. It's really a rather minor procedure.
And Diane from Fort Wayne, Indiana, asks your thoughts about talk therapy.
Well, I believe in it entirely, and not just because my brother-in-law and sister are psychologists. I always believe that it's a good idea to talk, and I'd done that in college and in graduate school. When I was going through some issues, I sought out the free counseling at the colleges where I attended school and had great experiences with the counselors that I had. And after I went through this depression that led to the writing of The Incurables, I did and I do have a therapist I work with, not as frequently as I did in the beginning, immediately after my depressive episode. But every 6 weeks or so, we regroup and talk, and it's been a positive experience.
All right. And here's a caller in Morristown, Tennessee. Good morning, Bonnie.
I enjoy your program tremendously.
Thank you. And
this is just right up my alley. I had one session back in the 60s, and with electroshock therapy. And then 14 years ago, I had a reoccurrence, I guess you'd call it. And we really, my husband and I really didn't know what to do. And the worst, the hardest thing I ever did was to sign myself in to a mental institution. I found the change was wonderful, though. I'd had the shock therapy at first, and they said that you were anesthetized. I, to this day, do not believe I was.
Wow.
And I was 19 or 20 at the time. I'm 68 now. And the second time, that was the reason I didn't want to go back. And I had to go that far. That time, I was anesthetized. I can't say it. And it's like the difference in daylight and dark. Shock therapy is not for everybody. Even had a very good friend who asked me if I saw things when I was depressed. And I said, I did not have schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
I was depressed. And that's been about 14 years ago.
Mm.
And I still carry a little bit. I carry a lot of baggage.
Well, yeah, and these are never easy decisions, but it's depression needs an out. And so I think it's helpful to think about all kinds of possible treatments or solutions. And if running an hour a day is enough to lift the depression, then let's go with running. And if it's an antidepressant, then that seems worthwhile to try. And if in serious cases, as yours apparently was, Bonnie, and mine was, then ECT might be one of those options. So I think just opening ourselves to thinking about a range of options to get at this depression, because depression is not a state we want to be in at all, and not for very long, for sure.
Are you ever fearful it will come back?
Well, I was talking to my colleague Katie Ryan not too long ago about this, and we were talking about the story Sonny's Blues by James Baldwin, in which one of the protagonists had a heroin addiction, and he's off heroin, and his brother's talking to him, and Sonny says to him, you know, it could come back, his addiction, his connection with heroin. And I think that's true of depression. It could come back. I hope it doesn't. But I have from time to time felt the edges of it, just a little tickle of it, to know that it's still there and is still something I have to be aware of, keep my eye on, and not to think I've overcome entirely. That it's...
What does that feel like when it's at the edges?
In my case, I begin to feel a sense of dread and a little bit of anxiety, and this pulling at my soul or psyche, this pulling down, this sense of helplessness, the sense of defeat. It isn't strong when I feel just it at the edges, but it just tickles those emotions enough to make me cognizant that it's out there.
Let's go to Annapolis, Maryland. Good morning, Sophie.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate it.
Of course.
And I'd just like to say, Mark, that I'm really touched by your honesty and your courage in speaking about depression and mental health as you are. And
thank you, Sophie.
And I don't know if this is a comment or a question or what, but what I'm really struck with is, in this country, it seems that mental health is still considered a bugaboo. And depression, when you were talking, when you were first talking, I started to think about, is depression or this whole topic, is it a messenger of something that's going on sort of in the bigger field of consciousness or humanity, that if we, the way we look at it, it seems like there's something wrong or that it's bad. And I don't want to belittle or at all what people go through when they have to go through these kinds of things. But I just wonder if it's a way, if we were able to look at it in a way that it's actually telling us something about our world, and almost that people who are maybe in that state are paying attention to something that the rest of us are not, that it's almost like, how could you not be depressed with the way that things are going in our world? I mean,
yeah, you know, no, absolutely, Sophie. I think that's right. And that in part is what my story, The Bridge, is about, where the world itself seems to, or the people in the world seem to be responding to this larger sense of hopelessness that somehow the world has created around us, or we've created in the way we interact with each other. So I do think, as I said at the onset of the show, that there is a lot to be angry or depressed about. And when we don't have the resources, when we don't have the friendships, the family, the support around it, it's especially difficult. But even when we do, it's still difficult. And so, yes, I agree that there are some issues in our world, in our society that feed
depression.
That depress us. Thank you. That's it.
And, you know, and that it is not in our personal individual power.
That's right.
To make right.
That's right.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Would you read for us from that last story, Classmates?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And this is a story about a man who has tried to kill himself and has failed. And he's visiting the wife of a classmate who has succeeded in killing himself. And he's just visited her in this scene, and he's reflecting a little on that visit. And there's the mention of the phrase, 5 minutes, no more. The you character, the protagonist, has attempted to kill himself by asphyxiation in his garage. And a doctor told him he had 5 minutes, no more, and he would have been dead. So here's from Classmates, the last story in The Incurables. You call your wife, but she isn't in. You leave a message saying you will be spending the night at a hotel and will be home sometime after noon the following day. 300 miles or so down the road, you pull into a Days Inn. Later, eating dinner at a Cracker Barrel, you think about your last exchange with your classmate's wife as you stood outside her front door in the vanishing light. I don't suppose you cured your depression by trying to kill yourself, she said from within her house. You shook your head. What did make you better? There was something hopeful in her voice, as if she might yet discover a remedy for her husband's pain. You told her about your stay in a psychiatric hospital, the antidepressants you were prescribed, your twice-a-week talk therapy sessions. And time, you said, although she no longer seemed to be listening. And luck. You vow to call your classmate's wife, Jennifer, Jen, tomorrow, to thank her for seeing you, to see how she's doing. You return to your hotel room and watch television until midnight, but even then you aren't tired. You read articles in the 4 alumni magazines you have brought with you. It is nearly 2 in the morning when you turn off the light, but after 15 minutes you know you won't be able to sleep, so you check out of the hotel and drive home. You pull into your driveway at dawn. You don't have the garage opener, so you leave your car in the drive. You have crossed over from tiredness into numbness, a dreamlike sensation, what you might experience in the first few seconds after receiving anesthesia. It is like existing between two worlds, neither of them quite accessible through your 5 senses. You walk around to the back of the house and stand outside the kitchen in front of a window whose yellow curtains have been drawn back. As you anticipated, the kitchen light is on, and your wife, her black hair in a ponytail, is at the table, the newspaper and a cup of coffee in front of her. Your eyes have trouble focusing, and the scene seems as much memory or wish as reality. She reads for a few minutes before taking a sip. When she puts down her cup, she looks out the window. You want to acknowledge her, but you find yourself frozen in place. She continues to stare directly at you, her expression, if it holds any emotion, downcast. You remember the fume-filled garage and the blackness overwhelming your consciousness. 5 minutes, no more. You step forward and press your lips against the window, kissing its coolness. Your wife smiles and kisses you back.
Mark Brazite is reading from the last of the short stories. It's called Classmates in his new collection, The Incurables. Mark, having written this now, how do you feel about yourself?
Oh, I don't know that I feel any differently about myself than I do for having written this book or not written this book. I feel it was an important book to write for many reasons, some of which I'm still puzzling through and figuring out. But one of the reasons I did want to write it, and I believe in, you know, I was a former Peace Corps volunteer. I believe in going out there in the world, and I wanted to reach people through this book, and I hope I have.
I think you have. Here is the last email from Randy. I want to thank Mr. Brazitis for his openness about his struggle with depression. It has inspired me to keep the faith that I will get better and not to stop treatment and seeking help.
That's fabulous.
Mark Brazitis, the book is titled The Incurables. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rain.
Support for NPR comes from NPR members.